And this attitude would preserve the spiritual feelings of God, because a person would not lose them through his own lowly kind of operation, nor would he extinguish the spirit. A person extinguishes the spirit by wanting to conduct himself in a way different from that in which God is leading him. He acts in this way if he desires, when God gives him the spirit passively, as he does through these apprehensions, to be active by working with the intellect or by desiring something in these apprehensions. This is clear, for if the soul would then want to work, its activity would necessarily be no more than natural. On its own, it can do no more, since the soul does not move itself to a spiritual work, nor can it. But God moves it and places it in the supernatural activity. If then a person were to desire to make use of his own efforts, he would necessarily impede by his activity the passive communication of God, which is the Spirit. He would be engaging in his own work, which is of another and lower kind than that which God is communicating to him. The work of God is passive and supernatural, that of man active and natural. This natural activity of man is what would extinguish the spirit. That this is a more lowly work is also clear, because the faculties of the soul cannot of themselves reflect and operate except upon some form, figure, or image, which would be the rind and accident of the substance and the spirit. This substance and spirit is not united with the faculties of the soul in true understanding and love until the operation of the faculties ceases. For the aim of this activity is the reception of substantial understanding and love through these forms. The difference between the active and passive operation is the same as that between what is being done and what is already done, or what one intends to attain and what is already attained. Thus we also deduce that if a person were to desire to employ his faculties actively in these supernatural apprehensions by which, as we said, he receives the Spirit passively from God, he would be doing nothing less than abandoning what has been accomplished in order to redo it. Neither would he be enjoying what was done, nor by his activity doing anything other than impeding God's work. For as we said, these actions cannot independently attain the spirit God was giving to the soul without them. If the soul pays heed to these imaginative apprehensions, it directly extinguishes the spirit which God infuses by means of them. Consequently, a person should abandon these apprehensions and behave passively and negatively, because then God moves the soul to what transcends its power and knowledge. The prophet accordingly declared, "I shall stand upon my watch and fix my foot upon the tower, and I shall contemplate what is said to me." This is like saying, "I shall stand upon the watch of my faculties and take no step forward in my operations. Thus I shall be able to contemplate what is told me. I shall understand and taste what is communicated to me supernaturally." The words of the bridegroom, which were quoted in the objection, should be interpreted as referring to the love that he asks of the bride. It is a characteristic of love to assimilate lovers to one another in their spiritual faculties. As a result, he tells her to set upon him as a mark upon her heart. Canticles 8:6. There where all the arrows of love, the actions and motives of love that come from the quiver strike. He does this so that all the arrows might strike him who is there as their target, and thus all are directed to him. And the soul becomes like him through its actions and movements of love until transformed in him. He tells her to set him also as a mark upon her arm, because the act of love is on the arm, since by the arm the beloved is held and caressed. In these apprehensions coming from above, imaginative or any other kind, it matters not if they be visions, locutions, spiritual feelings, or revelations. A person should advert only to the love of God they interiorly cause. He should pay no attention to the letter and rind which signify, represent, or make known. Thus he should pay heed not to the feelings of delight or sweetness, not to the images, but to the feelings of love that are caused. Only for the sake of moving the spirit to love should the soul at times recall the images and apprehensions which produced love. Though the effect produced by the remembrance of this communication is not as strong as at the time the communication was received, yet when the communication is recalled, there is a renewal of love and an elevation of the mind to God. This is especially true when the soul remembers some figures, images, or supernatural feelings. These are usually so imprinted on it that they last a long time. Some are never erased from the soul. These apprehensions produce, almost as often as remembered, divine effects of love, sweetness, and light, sometimes in a greater degree, sometimes in a lesser, because God impressed them for this reason. This is consequently a great grace, for the person upon whom God bestows it possesses within himself a mine of blessing. The figures producing such effects are vividly impressed upon the soul and are unlike other images and forms preserved in the fantasy. The soul has no need of recourse to this faculty when it desires to remember them, for it is aware that it has them within itself as an image in a mirror. And when a soul possesses these figures formally within itself, it can safely recall them for the procuring of the effect of love I mentioned, because they will not be a hindrance to the union of love and faith, providing it is undesirous of being absorbed with the figure. It must profit from the love by immediately leaving aside the figure. By such procedure, the remembrance will instead be a help to the soul. It is difficult to discern when these images are impressed on the soul and when on the fantasy, for those of the fantasy are also quite frequent. Some persons who usually have imaginative visions find that these same visions are very frequently represented in their fantasy, either because they themselves possess a very lively faculty, so that with little thought The ordinary figure is immediately represented and sketched. Or because the devil causes these representations, or also because God causes them without impressing them formally in the soul. Nonetheless, they can be discerned through their effects. For those that are of natural or diabolical origin produce no good effect or spiritual renovation in the soul, no matter how often they are remembered. The individual beholds them in dryness. When remembered, however, the imaginative apprehensions from God produce some good effect by means of that which they imparted to the soul the first time. Yet the formed apprehensions, those impressed on the soul, yield some effect about every time they are recalled. Anyone with the experience of these will easily be able to tell the difference between the two, for the diversity between them is very clear. I merely assert that those impressed formally on the soul, in which a way as to be long-lasting, are of rarer occurrence. But whatever may be their kind, it is good for the soul to have no desire or comprehend anything save God alone in hope through faith. As for the other point in the objection, that it is apparently pride to reject these apprehensions if they are good, I answer, it is rather prudent humility to benefit by them in the best way, and has been mentioned, and be guided along the safest path. Chapter 14. We placed apprehensions of spiritual knowledge in the third class, not because they pertain to the corporeal fantasy, for they do not have a corporeal image and form, as the others do, but because they are likewise the object of spiritual reminiscence and memory. For after the soul receives knowledge of this sort, it can at will bring it back to memory. It remembers this not through the effigy or image left in the corporal sense faculty, for in being a corporal sense faculty, the fantasy has no capacity for spiritual forms. It remembers intellectually and spiritually through the form impressed on the soul, which is also a spiritual or formal form, idea or image, or through the effect produced. As a result, I classify these apprehensions among those of the memory, even though they do not belong to those of the fantasy. We have given a sufficient explanation in Chapter 24 of Book 2. Chapter 26, whereas we discussed intellectual apprehensions of this kind of knowledge and of the attitude toward it required for advancement to union with God. See that chapter, because there we have explained how these apprehensions are of the two kinds, one referring to the Creator and the other to creatures. Concerning what has to do with our intention here, which is to explain the way the memory should conduct itself in order to advance to union, I merely state, as I have just explained in the preceding chapter about formal images, to which class this knowledge of creatures belongs, that this knowledge may be remembered when it produces a good effect, not in order to retain it, but to awaken the knowledge and love of God. But if the remembrance of this knowledge of creatures produces no good effect, the soul should never desire the memory of it. But as for knowledge of the Creator, I declare that a person should strive to remember it as often as possible, because it will produce in the soul a notable effect. For as we affirmed there, the communications of this knowledge are touches and spiritual feelings of union with God, the goal to which we are guiding the soul. The memory does not recall these through any form, image, or figure that may have been impressed on the soul, for those touches and feelings of union with the Creator do not have any. It remembers them through the effect of light, love, delight, and spiritual renewal produced in it. Something of this effect is renewed as often as the soul recalls them. Chapter 15 of Book 3. To conclude this discussion on the memory, then, it will be worthwhile to delineate briefly a general method for the use of the spiritual person, that he may be united with God according to this faculty, even if it clearly understands from what we said, the reader will grasp it more easily in a summary. The following must be kept in mind. Our aim is union with God in the memory. The object of hope is something unpossessed. The less other objects are possessed, the more capacity and ability there is to hope for this one object, and consequently the more hope, the greater the possessions, the less capacity and ability for hope, and consequently so much less of hope. Accordingly, in the measure that a person dispossesses his memory of forms and objects which are not God, he will fix it upon God and preserve it empty, in the hope that God will fill it. That which a person must do in order to live in perfect and pure hope in God is this: as often as distinct ideas, forms, and images occur to him, he should immediately, without resting in them, turn to God with loving affection, in emptiness of everything rememberable. He should not think or look upon these things for a longer time than is sufficient for the understanding and fulfillment of his obligations, if they refer to this. And then he should consider these ideas without becoming attached or seeking gratification in them, lest they leave their effects in the soul. Thus a man is not required to cease recalling and thinking about what he must do and know, for since he is not attached to the possession of these thoughts, he will not be harmed. The verses of the Mount in chapter 13 of the first book are helpful for this practice. Yet it must be noted here that by our doctrine we are not in agreement, nor do we desire to be, with that of those pestiferous men who, persuaded by the pride and envy of Satan, have sought to remove from the eyes of the faithful the holy and necessary use and the renowned cult of the images of God and of his saints. Our doctrine is far different from theirs. We are not asserting, as they do, that there be no images or veneration of them. We are explaining the difference between these images and God, and how souls should use the painted image in such a way that they do not suffer an impediment in their movement toward the living image, and how they should pay no more attention to images than required for advancing to what is spiritual. The means is good and necessary for the attainment of the end, as are images for reminding us of God and the saints. But when a person uses and dwells upon the means more than he ought, his excessive use of them becomes as much an impediment as anything else. This is even truer in the case of supernatural visions and images, with which I am expectingly dealing here, and which are the cause of many delusions and dangers. There is no delusion or danger in the remembrance, veneration, and esteem of images that the Catholic Church proposes to us in a natural manner, since in these images nothing else is esteemed than the person represented. The memory of these images will not fail to be profitable to a person, because this remembrance is accompanied with love for whoever is represented. Images will always help a person toward union with God, provided that he does not pay more attention to them than is necessary, and that he allows himself to soar. When God bestows the favor from the painted image to the living God, in forgetfulness of all creatures and things pertaining to creatures. Chapter 16 of Book 3. We would achieve nothing by purging the intellect and memory in order to ground them in the virtues of faith and hope, if we neglected the purification of the will through charity, the third virtue. Through charity, works done in faith are living works and have high value. Without it, they are worth nothing, as St. James affirms. Without works of charity, faith is dead. James 2:20. For a treaty on the active night, an demudation of the faculty, with the aim of instructing and educating it in this virtue of the love of God, I have found no more appropriate passage than the one in chapter 6 of Deuteronomy, where Moses commands, "You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, and with all your soul, and with all your strength." Deuteronomy 6:5. This passage contains all that a spiritual man must do, and all that I must teach him here, if he is to reach God by union of the will through charity. In it, man receives the command to employ all the faculties, appetites, operations, and emotion of his soul in God, so that he may avoid the use of his ability and strength for anything else in accord with David's declaration. The strength of the soul comprises the faculties, passions, and appetites. All this strength is ruled by the will. When the will directs these faculties, passions, and appetites toward God, turning them away from all that is not God, the soul preserves its strength for God and comes to love him with all its might.